Good evening, everybody. I'm Sidney Harmon, and this evening is entitled Auden and Shakespeare. This fellow, Auden, was a most interesting cat. Dana Joya and I were arguing about how, I think we were arguing about what year it was in which he died, but I think we got it figured out. 1973, he was 66 years old. Does that work, David? A man who lived a quite fascinating life. Numbers of interesting partners, Christopher Isherwood. He was in many ways both a contemporary and a disciple of T.S. Eliot. And his writings vary from the political radical to the whimsical. He had, it seemed to me, a particular fondness for parable and the mirror. He wrote his own version of the Shakespeare Tempest and lectured frequently about Tempest here in this country. And when he spoke of the mirror, he said something to the effect that every man has a mirror, which is as irresistible and irreplaceable and indisposable as his shadow. David Mason and Dana Joya and Michael Kahn will hold for us a mirror to W.H. Auden and Billy Shakespeare.
Beginning with Bill and ending with Wisdom. And the combination actually makes a lot of sense because Shakespeare is one of the central focus of Auden's life. And we thought we would begin with Michael Kahn talking about Shakespeare. He's going to talk about three monologues on love and talk about Shakespeare's development. We'll do a few sonnets, and then we'll move to the 20th century.
I was very pleased when Dana called me up and said, why don't we do Auden and Shakespeare, because I come here basically to learn, so I'm going to learn a lot about Auden tonight. But I know Auden basically partly as a playwright and as an opera librettist. So, but I thought, a lot of people have asked me for the last couple of years sort of about how I work on text, and so I thought, well, since we're really talking about poetry and versification and language, that maybe I would use a couple of examples of Shakespeare just to talk a little bit about Shakespeare's development and also how Shakespeare portrays high emotion at different times of his life. And this is a little bit suggested last night when someone asked Michael York what his favorite speech from Romeo and Juliet was. So I thought I would start. Romeo and Juliet's a very, very early play of Shakespeare's, and so what you're going to hear, what we're going to start with now, and something I'm sure you know, but it's actually Romeo's first major speech in the play. And so here's where a playwright actually tries to delineate the character for the audience, and let's see what he does here. Now, this is an early play, so it's in really regular verse, and he's having a little bit of fun. So I'm not Michael York, but I'm going to read it as best I can. All right. So this is Romeo. We just heard from Benvolio, who's been talking to Romeo's parents, that Romeo is extremely sad. And nobody seems to know why. And so he is confronted by Benvolio. And somewhere in the middle of the scene, Benvolio says to Romeo, in love. And Romeo says, out. And Benvolio says, of love. And Romeo says, out of her favor, where I am in love. And Benvolio says, alas, that love, so gentle in his view, should be so tyrannous, and rough in proof. I'm going to put on my glasses. And Romeo's first big speech goes like this. Alas, that love whose view is muffled still should without eyes see pathways to his will? Where shall we dine? O me, what fray was here? Yet tell me not, for I have heard it all. Here's much to do with hate, but more with love. Why then, O brawling love, O loving hate, O anything of nothing first create, O heavy lightness, serious vanity, misshapen chaos of well-seeming forms, feather of lead, bright smoke, cold fire, sick health, still waking sleep that is not what it is. This love feel I, that feel no love in this. And this is Romeo's first speech. It actually says right after that, dost thou not laugh? And so we see very regular poetry. We also see a very young playwright having some fun in using a series of oppositions in describing a serious emotion. But what do we get from this? We get a sense, actually, that this is not real language, that people don't actually talk like this. Who talks like this? Somebody talks like this who has read a lot of literature, a lot of poetry, and is inventing somehow a feeling that he doesn't quite understand and is translating it through metaphors that I think are received. It's very clever writing. So when you talk about things like, heavy lightness, serious vanity, the playwright is having fun in learning how to do this, but also he's describing a young man who probably yet hasn't really felt the fullest feelings and experiencing fully of love. And actually he doesn't until he meets Juliet later on in the play. And so while we have a young playwright having an enormous amount of glee and in a way showing off his ability to play with language, I think he's also delineating character in a certain way. Now, 8 years later, we have Hamlet's first speech, and the language changes considerably. First of all, it's not as regular. When I say that, there are no, in this speech that I just said of Romeo's, the line of verse goes completely from beginning to end. There is really no interruption in the middle of the line. In this first speech of Hamlet's, there are many lines which end in the middle of another line. And when a line ends in the middle of another line with a full stop, it suggests a significant transition in the middle of a line of verse. In this, there are none. In this, there are. And listen to see whether it begins to sound differently, perhaps less artificial and more indicative of how the playwright can now begin to express a complicated feeling. Now, in this scene, this is Hamlet's very first speech when he's left alone in the very first scene. He has just come back from Wittenberg. His father has died. His mother has married his uncle. And he has been asked to stay at home. And he is left alone for the first time. And this is what Shakespeare, now 8 years later and a more mature writer, is actually able to say. And he says, oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew, or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. Oh, God, God. How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie on it, fie. 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this, but 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion, to a satyr, so loving to my mother, that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth, must I remember? why she would hang on him, as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. And yet, within a month, let me not think on it, frailty, thy name is woman, a little month, or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body, like Niobe, all tears. Why she, even she, O God, a beast that wants discourse of reason would have mourned longer, married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. Within a month, yet ere the soul to most unrighteous tears had left the flushing in her galled eyes, she married. O most wicked speed to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not, nor it cannot come to good. But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue. And the difference in the language, between the use of language, between those 8 years is quite extraordinary. This is the way people in extremists think. And I'm going to go through it a little bit to show you sort of how the line is broken up. That Hamlet, that here Romeo has an idea and he plays with the idea. Here, Shakespeare is now able to write verse in which he can break up the verse so that you actually get the sense that somebody is thinking, and thinking rapidly, and thinking in several different directions at once, and sometimes the thought takes itself through two or three lines. So here we go again. The first line begins with an O. Extraordinary sound. An extraordinary thing to begin a line with. That sound itself, that O, that full vowel, can have in it such a depth of feeling. And he begins with that. And as an actor nowadays, you can't just say, oh, that this too solid flesh. You have to allow that O, that huge vowel, to have the huge weight that Shakespeare has given it as the first sound in that line. Oh, that this too sully flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. What kind of an image is that? That is a much richer image in talking about one's feelings than to say, as Romeo does, a series of oppositions. And he goes on, or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. And then the line comes to a stop, but the line is not finished, and still we have three more syllables. Oh God, God. So we immediately have a character who changes into a transition of another thought in the middle of a line, in the same way that as we're thinking in extremists, and we talk in extremists, we're able to do. Romeo couldn't do that early on. This playwright didn't understand that. And here he's beginning to understand how to create a line of verse that sounds the way we think, really think, and think in extraordinary circumstances. And then he says, oh God, God, and he starts the next line, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. And then he comes to another image, and not a clever image, but before that he says, fie on it, oh fie. And immediately he goes to another place. He's thinking about the world, and then he goes to another feeling, and he says, fie on it, fie, and he's someplace else, and then he comes back, as we do when we are upset, to the image he had before. Or he thinks of a new image, because this is a full stop in the middle of this line. So fie on it, oh fie, and then full stop, and then a new thought. What is the world like? 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. And we're in the middle of another line. And then he has a new thought. What's this garden like? Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. And so we see that Shakespeare has learned 8 years later to be able to put into verse the way a person thinks. Here in Romeo and Juliet, he is able to put into verse the way a person artificially feels. here he is starting to able to put into verse the way a person really feels. And this is the beginning, this extraordinary year where Hamlet was written and three other great plays, where Shakespeare's, the maturity of his ability to versify happens. As Harold Bloom says in this play, it's the beginning of consciousness. We actually have verse telling us exactly how a mind works and putting it in extraordinary form. Now, 10 years later, as his language again changed, the extraordinary thing about Shakespeare is, and I think this is why people can't believe that a man like Shakespeare himself could write it, is that Shakespeare, like great geniuses like Picasso, strove not to repeat himself. Picasso once said that a work of art should be the refuse of the stuff you knew before. It should be, in a sense, the garbage heap of what it was you've done before. And that Shakespeare continually sought to change his style. And the extraordinary thing that I think people can't understand is how can a man, you know, sort of lower middle class man with a certain amount of education from Stratford, be able to do this? And the truth is, I think he listened, I think he read, I think he had a mind and a heart greater than all of ours, and I think he was a genius. And I think geniuses grow in ways that other people don't. And for us to not imagine that this could be a man like this. But as he experimented later on in Winter's Tale, he starts to deal here now with another kind of language. And here he's now a man in extremis about jealousy. So we've had one kind of sort of artificial language in Romeo and Juliet, one kind of very honest but beautiful metaphoric language about betrayal and thought. And now we have a man in extremis, and see how this goes. Because Leontes has just seen his wife go off with his best friend. It happens to be an innocent relationship, but for a variety of reasons, and I think psychological reasons, Leontes now suspects that his wife and his best friend are having an affair. And so he begins the speech, and it's a shared line with, and he begins the speech, he says, "Too hot, too hot. To mingle friendships far is mingling bloods. I have tremor cordis in me. My heart dances, but not for joy, for joy. This entertainment may a free face put on, derive a liberty from hardiness, from bounty, fertile bosom, and well become the agent. May I grant, but to be paddling palms and pinching fingers as now they are, and making practiced smiles as in a looking glass, and then to sigh as 'twere the mort of the deer. Oh, that is entertainment my bosom likes not, nor my brows." And we are no longer back in natural language. We are now in language that is specifically heightened and using words in a particular way to create a situation that is far from normal. A man who is now in what we might consider a nervous breakdown. And at this time in his life, Shakespeare is beginning to use words again in a much more complicated and stylized way. So in the beginning, in Romeo and Juliet, his stylization came from, I think, received sources. Then through his great tragedies, his language came from a deep sense of humanity. And in his later plays, his language came from an extraordinary sense of how to heighten language in an almost artificial way. So he returned to a kind of formalistic use of language, but a language that he invented himself. So when we talk about other poets in the years to come, and poets who have always used Shakespeare, I think, as a model, it's good to see whether there's any relation between these two gentlemen.
Well, let's do a bit more of Shakespeare, because you've talked about Shakespeare as a dramatist, as a psychologist, you know, and as a poet. I love Shakespeare's miniatures, which are the sonnets. And this is one I think that you never see in anthologies, but it's absolutely wonderful. And it violates all of the proper rules of a modern poem. There is not a single image, metaphor, or simile to be found in this. It's all on paradox. And it's sort of what he was trying to do, I think, with Romeo in, early on. But here he brings it with complete fluidity. And it's a good poem for any middle-aged man to know. When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies, that she might think me some untutored youth, unlearned in the world's false subtleties, thus vainly thinking that she thinks me young, although we know my years are past the best, simply I credit her false-speaking tongue, a simple truth is thus on both sides suppressed. But wherefore says she not she is unjust? And wherefore not say not I that I am old? Ah, love's best purpose is in seeming trust. And age in love loves not to have years told. Therefore I lie with her, and she with me, and by our falsehoods we both flattered be. You want to do a song? Is it David?
Well, here's one that ought to sound familiar to most people. Trying to figure out where to hold this mic. The expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action. Until action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame. Savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust. Enjoyed no sooner but despise it straight. Past reason hunted, and no sooner had past reason hated as the swallowed bait on purpose laid to make the taker mad. Mad in pursuit and in possession so, had having an inquest to have extreme, a bliss in proof, but proved a very woe, before a joy proposed behind a dream. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. One thing I wanted to underline about that sonnet in relation to what Michael was saying is that Shakespeare is a man who not only listened to real emotions, but understood that rhetoric really does come from actual human emotions. And so when he makes these poems out of the tension of opposites, out of this explosion of opposing feelings, he's balancing perfectly what we feel and what we think. It makes him a great artist.
You know, it's. And I think this is really the transition between Shakespeare and Auden. Michael said something last night that I thought was the most brilliantly succinct definition of why Shakespeare is great, is that he doesn't tell us what to think. He tells us what to think about. And W.H. Auden once, I think I should let us stand so people, because there's a lot of people in the back, I don't know if you can.
Can you pull your mic up a little, David?
Okay. Can you hear me now? No?
I think it has to go up from here, doesn't it?
Okay. Once W.H. Auden defined poetry is the only socially acceptable way of saying two contradictory things at once. And that's an absolutely Shakespearean definition of poetry. And as we share some of Auden's poems, I think you'll see that what he characteristically does is he proposes something, and as soon as you begin to believe it, he changes it. He tells you the opposite. And he makes you go back and forth to understand that almost every truth looks different depending on what side you look at it. But first, a little bit about Auden for people that don't know about Auden. Still higher? Okay, I got to kiss the mic. Can you really not understand? Hear me if I speak with the voice God gave me.
Okay.
We have to do poetry in a more acoustically, positive place in the future. Auden was born in 1907 in York, England. And in fact, if you visit York this year, all of the cab drivers in York have memorized poems by Auden that they will recite to you as a civic pride program. His father was a doctor, very middle class. He went off to a public school. He attended Oxford, where he barely graduated, and got what they consider a high quality third, which means that you about as close as you can get to failing and still pass. When he graduated, he taught for a year, but then he went off to Berlin during the sort of the end of the Weimar period, the beginning of the Nazi period. You know his Berlin because you've all seen either the musical or the film Cabaret, which was written by his lover at the time, the Berlin stories by Christopher Isherwood. And so that basically describes the milieu in which they lived in Berlin. He then essentially became a kind of wandering writer. He did a travel book on Iceland. He went to Spain during the Civil War. He traveled through China during the Civil War and the beginning of the Japanese invasion. And then came to the United States in 1939. And when the war broke out, he made the decision to stay in the United States. Which is very controversial. The main reason he made it for several reasons. The main reason he decided to stay in the United States was that he could have a degree of privacy that he could not in England. By the time Auden was 30 in England, he was so famous that his name had become an adjective, Audenesque. Magazines did issues especially devoted to him. He was, along with T.S. Eliot, the most famous poet in the British Isles. And it gave him a kind of scrutiny that made him feel uncomfortable, plus the fact that Auden was constantly developing and changing his views. He was a sort of a Freudian Marxist in the 30s. He went to Spain, hoping to be part of the revolution, but was so disturbed by the atrocities that he saw both sides committing that he became unsatisfied with, at that point, the conventional British leftist view of Marxism being the savior of humanity. And he came to the United States and began to think through things in a very serious way. Josef Brodsky said, and I think it's an estimable idea, obviously a debatable idea, that Brodsky considered W.H. Auden the smartest man of the 20th century, in that he took through so many of these things and in a sense created a synthesis of social, cultural, scientific, and philosophical ideas. And I thought we would begin with a couple of early poems. Well, you could hear him as an enfant terrible, and then go into the poems that he becomes more and more concerned with serious, moral, philosophical, political issues. But first, the early Auden. This is a show-off poem. It's the Auden-esque sound. This is a sound that still exists in our culture. Bob Dylan, you can relate this all the way back, Bob Dylan style, back to this phase of Auden's career, refracted perhaps through Dylan Thomas. It's called Doomsday Song. It's a show-off poem because it's a long poem with only three rhymes. Jumbled in the common box of their dark stupidity, orchid, swan, and Caesar lie. Time, who tires of everyone, has corroded all the locks, thrown away the key for fun. In its cleft the torrent mocks prophets who in days gone by made a profit on each cry, persona grata now with none, and a jackass language mocks poets who can only pun. Silence settles on the clocks. Nursing mothers point a sly index finger at the sky, crimson with the setting sun. In the valley of the fox gleams the barrel of a gun. Once we could have made the docks. Now it is too late to fly. Once too often you and I did what we should not have done. Round the rampant rugged rocks,
rude and ragged rascals run.
Yeah, do funeral blues.
Are you going to do it as I walked out?
We'll do that later.
Okay. Well, this is one you guys may remember from the movie Four Weddings and a Funeral. Speaks for itself. Stop all the clocks. Cut off the telephone. Prevent the dog barking with a juicy bone. Silence the pianos, and with muffled drum, bring out the coffin. Let the mourners come. Let airplanes circle moaning overhead, scribbling about the sky the message, he is dead. Put crepe bows round the white necks of the public doves, and let the traffic policemen wear black cotton gloves. He was my north, my south, my east, my west, my working week, and my Sunday rest, my noon, my midnight, my talk, my song. I thought that love would last forever. I was wrong. The stars are not wanted now. Put out every one. Pack up the moon and dismantle the sun. Pour away the ocean and sweep up the wood. For nothing now will ever come to any good.
So you know what, so you see Auden doing, the first poem, he takes a nursery rhyme rhythm and he turns it into an apocalyptic poem. Here he takes a kind of it's actually a cabaret song kind of rhythm and creates a kind of lament. The next one, he takes the oldest of the popular British forms, the ballad, and he turns it into kind of an existential poem. This poem also was quoted in a movie, but not one so good as Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Four Sunrises?
Yeah, I think this is, well, it's actually also quoted in a bad sort of thriller film, too. It's, you know, Auden is very popular with script writers. When they're writing a bad film and they want to let you know that they're literary, they sneak in a quote from Auden. This is called As I Walked Out One Evening. As I walked out one evening, let me just point out, this is a Shakespearean poem, because as soon as you one voice convinces you that they're speaking the truth, the opposite is argued. As I walked out one evening, walking down Bristol Street, the crowds upon the pavement were fields of harvest wheat. And down by the brimming river, I heard a lover sing under the arch of a railway. Love has no ending. I'll love you, dear, I'll love you till Africa and China and Africa meet, till the river jumps over the mountain and the salmon sing in the street. I'll love you till the oceans are folded and hung to dry and the seven stars go squawking like geese about the sky. The years may run like rabbits, but in my arms I'll hold the flower of the ages and the first love of the world. But all the clocks in the city began to whir and chime. Oh, let not time deceive you. You cannot conquer time. In headaches and in worry, vaguely life leaks away. And time will have his fancy, tomorrow or today. Into many a green valley drifts the appalling snow. Time breaks the threaded dances and the diver's brilliant bow. Oh, plunge your hands into water, plunge them up to the wrist, stare, stare in the basin, and wonder what you've missed. The glacier knocks in the cupboard, the desert sighs in the bed, and the crack in the teacup opens a lane to the land of the dead. Where the beggars raffle the banknotes, and the giant is enchanting to Jack, and the lily-white boy is a roarer, and Jill goes down on her back. Oh, stand, stand by the mirror. No, stare, stare in the mirror. No, what is it? Stand, stand, stand in the window, with tears stalled and scarred. You must love your crooked neighbor with your crooked heart.
No, it's a look in the mirror. Look in your distress. Life remains a blessing, although you cannot bless. Oh, stand by the window as the tears scald and start. And just listen to this line. You must love your crooked neighbor, line break, with your crooked heart. The clocks then were silent. It was late in the evening. The lovers, they were all were gone. The clocks had ceased their chiming, and the dear river ran on. So.
That's one of my favorite poems, and I used to recite it to the woman who's my wife and she always called it the Salmon Song, and she had seven stars inscribed inside my wedding ring, you know, until the seven stars go squawking like geese about the sky. I keep reminding her that the poem goes on to say, you know, the glacier knocks in the cupboard, the desert sighs in the bed, and the crack in the teacup opens a lane to the land of the dead, but she doesn't want to remember that part of the poem. But the great thing about the poem is that, as Dana was saying, there's this wonderful way, like Shakespeare, in which Auden lets the experience itself have a kind of mystery, a whiff of mystery about it. At the end, the deep river runs on, and you don't really know what is continuing. You know, there's an eye that speaks, there's a clock that speaks, and there's a river that keeps moving on beyond all that speech. Auden was a great social satirist, and in the period when he was dealing with all this political activity in the 30s, he was certainly participating in the kind of political thought that animated George Orwell's work, but he was also profoundly influenced by the skeptical theology of Soren Kierkegaard and by the modernist writings of Franz Kafka. And I think you can see something of the Orwellian and the Kafkaesque in one of his most famous poems called The Unknown Citizen, which I'll try to remember. Begins with an inscription. To J.S. 07 M 378, this marble monument is erected by the state. He was found by the Bureau of Statistics to be one against whom there was no official complaint. And all the reports on his conduct agree that in the modern sense of an old-fashioned word, he was a saint. For in everything he did, he served the greater community. Except for the war, till the day he retired, he worked in a factory and never got fired, but satisfied his employers, Fudge Motors, Inc. Yet he wasn't a scab or odd in his views, for his union reports that he paid his dues. Our report on his union shows it was sound. And our social psychology workers found that he was popular with his mates and liked to drink. The press are convinced that he bought a paper every day and that his reactions to advertisements were normal in every way. Policies taken out in his name prove that he was fully insured. And his health card shows that he was once in hospital but left it cured. Both producers' research and high-grade living declare that he was fully sensible to the advantages of the installment plan and had everything necessary to the modern man, a phonograph, a radio, a car, and a Frigidaire. Our researchers into public opinion are content that he held the proper opinions for the time of year. When there was peace, he was for peace. When there was war, he went. He was married and added five children to the population, which our eugenist says is the right number for a parent of his generation. And our teachers report that he never interfered with their education. Was he free? Was he happy? The question is absurd. Had anything been wrong, we would certainly have heard.
Is it Auden's particular genius, you know, is to take these political, moral, social, philosophical points and embed them, as poetry must, in pleasure. And he has a way, in a sense, of making a very complicated argument in an irresistible sort of way. And he is a writer, in a sense, that as you follow his career, you see him working through
most of the ideologies of the 20th century. There's something that was interesting about him, though, which is that if he felt that one of his poems was something that was no longer to his own satisfaction fully true, he dropped it from his canon. A complete Auden has just been released in which just the list of titles in small print of the poems that he no longer would allow to be reprinted fills 3 pages. These are some of the most famous poems of the 20th century. And it was this notion that poetry, although it was about pleasure, although it was a kind of musical, artistic medium, had to serve the purposes of truth. Now, perhaps the most famous case of a poem that was dropped from the canon was one that occurred to me and many other people who knew Auden's work on September 11th, 2001. It was a poem that was pretty much not in print at that point. It was only one book that it was available in, because Auden had suppressed it actually 40 years before. It's called September 1st, 1939. Most audiences, we would have to point out what happened that day. I don't think that we have to remind this audience that's when World War II broke out, when Hitler invaded Poland and the Russians did not respond. And people understood that the war, a war of enormous consequence, was about to break out. Auden was in New York. He sets the poem in a bar. The important thing to realize about the bar is that people, like here, are sitting along a bar. What are they looking at? A mirror. You have to sort of understand the physical, in that. That explains about 90% of the critical difficulties of this poem. That it's in a bar, there's music playing, there's a mirror people are staring at. Now, the greatness of this poem is that it begins in politics, and in a sense it ends in moral philosophy, because what Auden is doing is, at a moment when, to quote him, each language pours forth its vain excuse, that people are talking about this endlessly, trying to figure out what happened with Hitler, what happened with Germany, why did this thing happen, Auden goes back essentially into a view of human nature, not in any sense trivializing or bypassing the history of Germany, but it's not in his mind about war repayments. It's not about Chamberlain or the Munich Compromise. It's about something far more troubling. There's a couple of allusions in this poem that you don't really need to know to understand it, but to comfort you. Let me explain. Diaghilev, the great impresario of Ballet Russe, Nijinsky, his great a male ballet dancer who went crazy. Nijinsky, in his memoirs, wrote that there was the thing about Diaghilev is Diaghilev didn't believe in universal love, this kind of apocalyptic vision of this change in human nature. Diaghilev was selfish, only wanted to have people love him. Thucydides is one of the great Greek historians. His greatest work is about the collapse of Athenian democracy in the Peloponnesian Wars. Hitler was raised in the town of Linz. Is there anything else that the allusions? I think those are the only ones you really need to know. 52nd Street in New York is a street that full of bars and jazz clubs. September 1st, 1939. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Accurate scholarship can unearth the whole offense from Luther until now. Find what occurred at Linz, what huge imago made a psychopathic god. I and the public know what all schoolchildren learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Exiled Thucydides knew everything a speech can say about democracy and what dictators do, the elderly rubbish they talk to an apathetic grave, analyzed all in his book, Enlightenment Driven Away, the habit-forming pain, mismanagement, and grief. We must suffer them all again. Into this neutral air, where blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man, each language pours its vain, competitive excuse. But who can live for long in a euphoric dream? Out of the mirror they stare, imperialism's face and the international wrong. Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort assume the furniture of home, lest we see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the dark, who have never been happy or good. The windiest militant trash important persons shout is not so crude as our wish. What Mad Nijinsky wrote about Diaghilev is true of the normal heart, of the error bred in the bone of each woman and each man craves what it cannot have, not universal love, but to be loved alone. From the conservative dark into the ethical light, the dense commuter comes, repeating his morning vow. I will be true to the wife. I'll concentrate more on my work. And the helpless governors wake to resume their compulsory game. Who can release them now? Who can reach the, who can speak for the dumb? Who can reach the deaf? All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man on the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. Defenseless under the night, the world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them, of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame.
That's great. Why did he suppress that?
Michael asked a question.
When did he decide to excise that from his work?
Well, he said. I mean, if you look at this, he says why.
When did he decide?
Why and when did Auden decide to suppress the poem? It's because of the line, "We must love one another or die," and Auden said that we're going to die anyway. And so he changed the line to, we must love one another and die, which is, actually a reasonable statement. But then he said it sounded so flat as a poem that it didn't work. And so then he cut the stanza, but he said the poem didn't work without the stanza. So since he couldn't make it both beautiful and true, he dropped it.
But then he never heard you recite it.
Well, that was one of the Lord's tender mercies to him, I think.
And also Lyndon Johnson ended up using that line in the ad campaign which defeated Goldwater in 64 with the ad showing the mushroom cloud. Johnson's voice comes on saying, misquoting Auden and saying, we must love one another or we must surely die, which is a very interesting use of poetry. And it brings up something that relates to the poem I'd like to recite to you, because when Auden arrived in New York, it was January 1939, and Dana mentioned one reason Auden left England and stayed away from England when the war broke out. He ended up being denounced in the House of Commons as a coward for doing this. He and Christopher Isherwood were both denounced for having done this. They were made fun of by writers like Evelyn Waugh, who just despised them for doing this. But Auden was also very much aware that he was in danger of becoming a kind of propagandist for the British Empire, a kind of national poet. And the figure alive on the planet Earth who was the epitome of the national poet, the nationalist poet, was William Butler Yeats. When Auden arrived in New York in January 1939, Yeats had just died in the south of France. And Auden spent a number of years, as it were, exorcising the ghost of William Butler Yeats. Now, the poem I'm going to recite to you is called Atlantis. And I'm convinced that Auden had in mind, Yeats's great poem called Sailing to Byzantium. You got to imagine a whole idea of poetry, that somehow or another the poem is about the journey we all make that has some goal at the end of it. We're all heading somewhere. We're trying to get somewhere. We want to achieve the perfect state, the just city, the good place, however you may define that. Well, Yeats says, "And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium." Sure. You want to hear Yeats? Okay, the Yeats poem goes like this. "That is no country for old men. The young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations of their song. The salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas. Fish, flesh, or fowl commend all summer long whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Caught in that sensual music, all neglect monuments of unaging intellect. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. Nor is there singing school, but studying monuments of its own magnificence. And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. O sages, standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, pern in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away. Sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is. And gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling, to set upon a golden bough, to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past or passing or to come." I think I dropped a line in there. But the idea is, the tension in Yeats is, and it's been with him from the beginning. Yeats is the guy saying, "I can escape Earth," but he's always pining for Earth. He's always trying to get back to Earth. It's just like Frost climbing the birch tree. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to understand how much Auden came to hate that poem. He considered it kind of... Thank you. How much he hated that poem. And because he felt it was a kind of hypnotic lie, it was a delusion, it was a vision of art in a sense that was a kind of narcotic fantasy. And he would say, you know, what grown man really wants to be a mechanical gold bird? You know, he would, you know, do. But it was, but Yeats, in a sense, was the thing he was playing against. The other person, though, is Cavafy.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I don't think Auden is fair to Yeats, because Yeats's golden bird is going to sing about the life of the body, about what is past or passing or to come. But as a student at Oxford in the 20s, Auden read T.S. Eliot's magazine. T.S. Eliot was publishing new translations of the great Greek poet Constantine Cavafy. Cavafy has a poem about a journey, too. It's called Ithaca. And in Cavafy's poem, what he says to you is, slow down. Don't be in a big hurry to get to Ithaca. And if you arrive at Ithaca finally and you discover that it is a poor, ragged place, maybe then you will understand that Ithaca has not betrayed you. Ithaca has given you the journey, the reason for the journey. And then you will understand what these plural Ithacas mean. So what Auden does is he writes a poem about the journey, but his journey is to Atlantis. So he's winking at us, right? He's sticking it to us. What's the end goal of your journey? It's to a place that maybe never existed, or if it had existed, it's at the bottom of the sea. So what is the idea you are journeying toward is the game in this poem. You'll notice that he takes you on the journey. He takes you step by step, stanza by stanza, in this wonderful syllabic verse that's really funny in the way it's written. And then, at the end, he just drops it all and prays. And then he prays to every god he can think of. This is the ultimate hedging your bets poem, okay? Okay. Being set on the idea of getting to Atlantis, you have discovered, of course, only the ship of fools is making the voyage this year, and that you must therefore be ready to behave absurdly enough to pass for one of the boys, at least appearing to love hard liquor, horseplay, and noise. Notice the rhyme of boys and noise. Very good. All right. Should storms, as may well happen, drive you to anchor a week in some old harbor city of Ionia, then speak with her witty scholars, men who have proved there cannot be such a place as Atlantis. Learn their logic, but notice how its subtlety betrays a simple, enormous grief. Thus they shall teach you the ways to doubt, that you may believe. If later you run aground among the headlands of Thrace, where with torches all night long a naked barbaric race leaps frenziedly to the sound of conch and dissonant gong, on that stony savage shore, strip off your clothes and dance. For unless you are capable of forgetting completely about Atlantis, you will never finish your journey. Again, should you come to gay Carthage or Corinth, take part in their endless gaiety, and if in some bar a tart, as she strokes your hair, should say, "This is Atlantis, dearie," listen with attentiveness to her life story. Unless you become acquainted now with each refuge that tries to counterfeit Atlantis, how will you recognize the true? Assuming you beach at last near Atlantis and begin the terrible trek inland through squalid woods and frozen tundras where all are soon lost, if forsaken then you stand, dismissal everywhere, stone and snow, silence and air. Oh, remember the great dead and honor the fate you are, traveling and tormented, dialectic and bizarre. Stagger onward rejoicing, and even then if, perhaps, having actually got to the last call, you collapse with all Atlantis gleaming below you, yet you cannot descend, you should still be proud even to have been allowed just a peep at Atlantis in a poetic vision. Give thanks and lie down in peace, having seen your salvation. All the little household gods have started crying. But say goodbye now and put to sea. Farewell, dear friend. Farewell. May Hermes, master of the roads, and the four dwarf Kabiri protect and serve you always. And may the Ancient of Days provide for all you must do his invisible guidance, lifting up, friend, upon you the light of his countenance.
Let's end with just two little light pieces, what James Joyce would have called a poem, but others call a poem. This is from his sequel to The Tempest. He created a speech for every character after the end of the poem, play. And this is the Master and Boatswain's song. And David, would you be willing to read the end of Auden's Phi Beta Kappa poem to Harvard? Just the last, the decalogue, the mock decalogue. It's turned to the right page. At Dirty Dick's and Sloppy Joe's, we drank our liquor straight. Some went upstairs with Marjorie.
and some, alas, with Kate. And two by two, like cat and mouse, the homeless played at keeping house. There, wealthy Meg, the sailor's friend, and Marion, the cow-eyed, opened their arms to me, but I refused to step inside. I was not looking for a cage in which to mope in my old age. The nightingales are sobbing in the orchards of our mothers, and hearts that we broke long ago have long been breaking others. Tears are round, the sea is deep. Roll them overboard and sleep. I gave the commencement address at Stanford 2 weeks ago. And as you know, the most thankless literary genre in the world is the commencement address. And I thought it would be fun just to hear how W.H. Auden ended his commencement address at Harvard in 1947. He's talking basically to a generation of men who've come back from World War II and have enrolled in college. And he ends with a kind of a mock decalogue.
Thou shalt not do as the dean pleases. Thou shalt not write thy doctor's thesis on education. Thou shalt not worship projects, nor shalt thou or thine bow down before administration. Thou shalt not answer questionnaires or quizzes upon world affairs, nor with compliance take any test. Thou shalt not sit with statisticians, nor commit a social science. Thou shalt not be on friendly terms with guys in advertising firms, nor speak with such as read the Bible for its prose, nor, above all, make love with those who wash too much. Thou shalt not live within thy means, nor on plain water and raw greens. If thou must choose between the chances, choose the odd. Read the New Yorker, trust in God, and take short views.
Any questions or comments?
I'd like to make a quote. Nancy Dudley, while you're standing out, Dudley. For Blake, to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, to hold, can't do it with one hand, to hold infinity in the palm of your hand or eternity in an hour. That's what we want to achieve.
Thank you. Sid.
Dana, you and Michael and David.
You, Michael and David, have all referred to Auden and Shakespeare, interpreting, as you did, the way each of them used the language, interpreted the way humans thought and spoke. I remember sometime in the 60s listening to Auden in New York speaking about Shakespeare. And I think I and others here might be interested in that more immediate relationship of Auden and Shakespeare. Auden did this play on the tempest, as I remember the sea and the mirror. Would you comment on Auden's views of Shakespeare as he spoke of them?
They're published now, by the way, the lectures at Harvard.
Yeah, Auden was obsessed with Shakespeare. I mean, really, that's the right word, throughout his whole career. And in fact, when he first came to New York, he got a job at the New School giving lectures on Shakespeare. And they were so well attended that the secretary at the New School said, I don't believe it's Auden lecturing on Shakespeare. It must be Shakespeare lecturing on Auden, if they're so popular. But I think what he admired in Shakespeare was what most of us do, was this Shakespeare's ability. And you can see this in Auden's work. What Auden is trying to get is everything into his poetry. Get everything into his poetry without, in a sense, lying or stereotyping things. And so it's the compendious nature of Shakespeare's
characters and plays and imaginations. He wrote a sequel to The Tempest. He adapted Love's Labor Lost as an opera for Nicholas Nabokov. And he wrote a number of poems that were inspired by Shakespeare, as well as a number of his best essays. And there's actually now, I think, two books published of his various lectures on Shakespeare.
This really relates to what Dana's been talking about how Auden believed that poetry was a kind of enchantment, but that the enchantment was dangerous, that it was too easy for us to say something beautifully and believe it. And I actually think Auden was too censorious with regard to his own work and the work of others like Yeats. But when he's writing about The Tempest and he's writing about Prospero and Ariel, the moment he's really interested in is the moment in which Prospero throws away his books, abandons magic, and has to live as an actual human being. And this is, for Auden, this is the central problem he's trying to work out. He tried to work it out politically in the 30s, and he's trying to work it out religiously in the 40s, in the long poem, spiritually. There's a great speech in the beginning of The Sea in the Mirror, his poem about the tempest. At one point, Prospero turns to Ariel and says, "And now, in my old age, I wake. And this journey really exists. And I have actually to take it, inch by inch, alone and on foot, without a cent in my pocket, through a universe where time is not foreshortened. No animals talk, and there is neither floating nor flying." And I think this is a central moment for Auden. This is the moment where he's really trying to understand that every human being is like Lear's unaccommodated man on the moor. Every human being has to make the journey, the same journey. It's what Atlantis is about. When Auden tried to be a pacifist for the first part of World War II, his gesture meant that he didn't want to be absorbed by the popular rhetoric of the war. And I think he probably misunderstood the situation, how grave it was to some extent. But he restrained himself from joining in the popular rhetoric in which evil was over there and not over here. And Auden theologically believed evil is everywhere and we have to face it everywhere. We can't just put it over there in the hands of other people. We have to assume that we partake in it in some way. Eventually what happened, of course, is that he joined the U.S. Army. He was the most unlikely officer in the U.S. Army, a major wearing bedroom slippers because of his bunions, and working in the Strategic Bombing Survey, in which he learned a hell of a lot about the effect of saturation bombing on civilian populations.
How old was he when he wrote the Tempest poem?
Born in 07, so the Tempest poem is 44, is that right? 43.
So that's actually a young man.
So he's unbelievable.
Basically young man.
Auden peaks early. He peaks early.
Shakespeare wrote that at the end of his writing career, The Tempest, but yeah. Auden writes this in somewhat like the middle of his career. Yeah.
I think one of the other things about Auden that's interesting is that if you think of Shakespeare's career, is that Shakespeare inherits the genres of his age, the history play, the tragedy, the comedy, and he creates at the end of his career what we, for lack of a better word, we call a romance, which is usually a play in which a tragic action is set in motion and somebody refuses, in a sense, to bring it to its tragic consequences, which almost inevitably involves forgiveness and redemption. So once Prospero has all of his enemies in his clutches, he instructs them, forgives them, redeems them. And I think
the meaning of the play, all was said
and done. And I think that's essentially the Shakespeare that Auden resembles. He refuses, in a sense, the tragic cliches. He understands the forgiveness of comedy, but in a sense, the nobleness of the romance is where I think that he ends up in terms of his Shakespearean vision. Yes?
Some time ago, I read a I read a biography of Auden in which they used the year 1939, and part of his reason for not returning to England was that he was homosexual, which was illegal, and that the decision to stay in the States was really based on that more than, and I was wondering, I was also struck by the fact that in your talking about his work, you don't talk about how his homosexuality of being an outsider at that time really affected how he saw the world, being an outsider, being someone who had grown up in a society who said his orientation was to be scorned. And I was wondering if you could talk to that just a bit.
Well, first of all, I mean, if you get into all of the reasons he stayed in England, he stayed in the United States, you know, one was that he'd fallen in love, you know, with Chester Coleman. And he did not want to leave the person he was in love with. You know, and whereas the earlier relationships, I think even when Auden was involved with them, he saw them as largely transitory and, you know, almost that he, I mean, he was almost a kind of emotionless lover in some ways in a lot of the early relationships. But see, I think it's the homosexuality is central to Auden, but I think Auden himself would indeed did point out it's simply one of the many, many, many ways in which he was alienated from the conventional opinion of his time. It was political, it was theological, it was literary, it was sexual, and he, was a person who, was his own man. And he, the ferocity with which the British left attacked him, when he sort of broke with Marxism was enormous. The ferocity which the British right attacked him when he stayed in America, the ferocity, which the American sort of liberals attacked him when he returned to the Anglican Church. I mean, he was somebody. If you read Orwell's attacks on Auden, you'd be astonished at their ferocity. He was somebody that at every step of his life was completely at ease with breaking from the crowd. And and I think there's a kind of moral courage in every moral courage and grace and good humor with Auden. I mean, it was wonderful. This is one of my favorite points in Auden's biography. Randall Jarrell, arguably the greatest American critic of his generation, couldn't believe when Auden, re-entered the church. And he wrote, I mean, two of the longest, most passionate assaults on a poet you can possibly imagine. You can read these things just for the quality of their rhetoric. And so, Auden's friends said, aren't you upset? He says, oh, no. Jarrell is upset because he's in love with me. And have somebody dismiss these attacks and credit the motive as love, to me says something about a man's moral character. And I think actually it was a little bit of truth in that with Jarrell.
Pardon me. Thank you, Derek.
There's no need for me to say this to any of you. I'm going to say it nonetheless. The Institute is increasingly determined to be properly respectful of the role of the arts in our lives and to turn away from treating them as somehow irrelevant decoration. I can say for myself that if I had any reason to be joyous about having come to Aspen this year, David and Michael and Dana have given it to me this evening. Thank you all for being here.
It was great. It was wonderful.